dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the War of Ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. We're going to talk about a subject that has not gotten nearly enough attention, I'm afraid, probably from our intelligence agencies, but certainly for the purposes of this conversation, the public at large, namely, what is North Korea doing to influence our country, to subvert us, perhaps from within, and to otherwise create conditions that will be advantageous to both the North Korean regime and its Chinese communist masters in Beijing. A man who has deeply studied these topics and to whom we have turned from time to time to gain insights into what the Kim Jong-un regime is doing here in our own country, let alone overseas, is Lawrence Peck. He has, over the years, served in a number of roles that have, I think, informed his understanding of this arcane subject. These days, he is an advisor at a terrific organization, the North Korean Freedom Coalition. Lawrence, it's so good to have you with us. Welcome back. Well, we're watching, revolutionary activities all over this country. And it's clear that many of them have a Marxist thrust to them, organizationally, doctrinally, operationally. What role do you see those who are identifiable as allies of, perhaps even in some cases, agents of, certainly agents of influence of, the regime in Pyongyang in that mix?
Well, I've been monitoring, studying, opposing, researching about the pro-North Korean movement in the U.S. for several decades since it began to grow and blossom, unfortunately, in the late 1990s and continuing up until the present. It's a collection, a highly interconnected network of closely allied, in some cases well-funded and also well-organized groups and activists who, to varying degrees along a spectrum, support, defend, make excuses for, act as lobbyists for, even, the dictatorship in North Korea. Some of these are front groups which pretend they're simply peace and unification advocates, while others are openly, proudly, boastfully pro-North. Some are composed of the small minority of Korean Americans who defend the North. Others are non-Korean American, just ordinary run-of-the-mill Marxist-Leninists who obviously support the North.
And to what extent are they tied in with Marxists of other stripes, notably some closely tied to communist China?
Well, that story goes back quite a few years, back to the Obama years when we had the Occupy movement, Occupy Wall Street and what have you. And it so happens that some of the pro-North groups in the U.S. actually had people who were involved in that movement, even at the leadership levels of that organization. And they've continued under the doctrine of so-called intersectionality. Many of your listeners may have heard of this, what the Marxist-Leninists used to call internationalism, whereby the different communist causes all around the world will support each other. So you'll have supporters of the communist New People's Army in the Philippines assisting pro-North Korean groups, and you'll have pro-North Korean groups supporting the Communist Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine, etc., etc. They're all basically seeing themselves fighting the same struggle against U.S. imperialism and its friends and allies. And recently, of course, they've been involved in this new revolutionary movement, which we now see unfolding before our eyes in the U.S.
And is there any doubt in your mind, as a serious student of the North Korean element of this Marxist revolutionary movement in America, Lawrence Peck, that they have a shared ambition to take down the government of the United States? This is not about racial justice or even more broadly sort of evolutionary change and improvements in the society of the United States. This is about displacing the government and constitution of the United States with something that is antithetical to the freedoms that we hold dear and the way of life that they make possible, is it not?
Yes, it is. And the pro-North groups and individuals are basically lobbying for a series of positions which the North itself favors, lobbying in terms of promoting their message to the media and also literally lobbying in terms of contacting sympathetic left-leaning congresspeople to, for example, the ones who focus purely on North Korea to oppose sanctions on the North and to oppose human rights nature on the North. But again, under this program of intersectionality, when they're involved in the whole gamut of far-left causes, they've been involved in some of these revolutionary activities we've seen just over the past couple of months. For example, on July 1st, there was a pro-terrorist rally over in Brooklyn. It was known as the Days of Rage, pro-Palestinian, anti-Israel event. And there you had speakers from a pro-North Korean group get up on the stage and say that they know that now that North Korea is a free country, they also want the U.S. to have its revolutionary struggle and become free like North Korea. And they had other guests there from other far-left and pro-Palestinian, pro-North groups, and there was the rhetoric to the effect of destroy Israel, destroy the United States, solidarity with North Korea, this kind of thing. So, of course, while they do focus primarily on the North Korea issue, they link arms and express solidarity on various occasions and through various campaigns with a whole variety of the far-left Marxist-Leninist groups. And these pro-North Korean groups, of course, although their primary focus is in defending, supporting North Korea and lobbying on its behalf here, they nevertheless, under this principle of intersectionality, internationalism, allying with their friends and comrades, they'll be involved in supporting far-left Marxist-Leninist movements, whether it's in the Middle East, whether it's in South America, and of course here in the U.S., as we've been discussing.
I think, Lawrence, that most of our listeners probably are agog at the idea that anyone would actually be lobbying or advocating on behalf of the North Korean regime. It is, after all, as you have devoted your life to documenting, arguably the most despicable, odious, and inhuman of all of the dictatorships in the world. And that's saying something when you're competing with the Chinese Communist Party, for example. But to think that anyone would actually posit that North Korea is free is simply beyond comprehension. And we're almost out of time, Lawrence, and I need to get you back to talk about one other aspect of this, which is a seeming alignment of the government of South Korea with such delusional thinking, which is of great concern to those of us who believe that the North is anything but free and would enslave the South and, for that matter, anybody else that they can get their hands on. But that's for another day, Lawrence. We will come back to you. But this important information about the enemy within our country, including the North Korean ones, and what they are doing in league with the Chinese Communist Party's proxies and agents to foster this revolution in our own country is of the utmost importance. We appreciate you and the work you do at the North Korean Freedom Coalition. Keep it up, my friend, and do come back to us very soon, if you would. We'll continue this conversation about the revolution here in the United States at the hands of, well, North Korean and other Marxists with one of our country's preeminent authorities on political matters, George Raceley of Conservative HQ. That and more straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
We're back, I'm very pleased to say, with a guest who is our duty genius, as a matter of fact. He is George Raceley. He is a certified genius, according to Mensa, the society of such very, very smart people. You can see how smart he is most days in his writings at Conservative HQ, a wonderful platform for, among other things, his writings and those of its founder, the great Richard Viguerie. He is an extraordinarily accomplished individual on several different fronts, notably as a political hand, having served in some 300 political campaigns, including every Republican presidential one from 1976 to 2008. He has also served in government, notably in the presidency of Ronald Reagan and George H.W. Bush, the latter serving on the staff of then Vice President Dan Quayle. George Raisley, it's so good to have you with us. Welcome back, sir. We have a lot to talk about and just a little bit of time to do it. I want to start with your appreciation of something we talked about a moment ago with Lawrence Peck, namely the revolutionary activity that is taking place in cities across America. It seems increasingly clear it is a Marxist revolution at that. Lawrence was talking about the North Korean dimension to it, but there are others, the Chinese and, you know, the Russians and so on. Would you characterize it that way as a serious student and practitioner of politics? And what are the implications if that's what we're up against at the moment?
Well, I absolutely would characterize it that way. I mean, that is Marxism is the fundamental driving force ideologically in this revolution that we're facing. There's lots of evidence that the North Koreans, the Chinese, the Russians, the Venezuelans, the Cubans have not only encouraged this ideologically, but you know, have operatives and money involved in it, either, you know, directly or through longtime sympathizers and fellow travelers. So it's, you know, it's quite clear just from what the leading revolutionaries say. Just look at the BLM, Black Lives Matter manifesto, and it's, you know, clear. That, you know, they say we're trained Marxists and their manifesto.
Deeply versed in the ideology. Right. And George, again, having studied and, you know, contested the free world's trajectory with these guys over the years in your various capacities, when we learn, as we did, I think it was Fortune magazine, if I'm not mistaken, that I believe released yesterday, the listing of Fortune 500 companies that have pledged or given money to this Marxist front organization, Black Lives Matter. In some cases, pledging as much as $1 billion. In other cases, hundreds of millions of dollars. What does that mean when we're watching corporate America fueling, presumably unwittingly, but shame on them if it is, because it has to be willful blindness that's applying here. They're putting that kind of money behind a group that has the overthrow of our country, certainly in their ideology, and I believe in their playbook.
Yeah, well, to understand that, you need to Google useful idiot. But, you know, what these guys are doing is what all useful idiots do in revolutions, which is to assume that if they, you know, throw some meat to the crocodile, that they will be the last ones eaten. And so it's, but it's very, very distressing because this revolution would be going nowhere without the support and the encouragement of corporate America. I mean, they're in the schools, they're spending millions of dollars to put this Marxist ideology into schools, starting in elementary school. And, you know, these corporate sponsors and the teachers' unions are rapidly advancing the revolution. And, you know, the teachers understand it because they're Marxists themselves. But the corporate leaders, I think, are just useful idiots for this whole thing. And it's astonishing that some very smart people who lead some of these big companies don't get it.
George, though, I have to say, I'm impressed that increasingly the role of people like Larry Fink, who is the founder and CEO of BlackRock and is enforcing now, using BlackRock's trillions of dollars under management and the ownership position that it provides them of stocks of lots of companies in this country, he's enforcing the so-called environment, social justice, and governance agenda, which is really the radical left's takeover of corporate America. The idea of, as Joe Biden put it the other day, stakeholder capitalism as opposed to shareholder capitalism. So I'm not sure that this is so much a case of people being useful idiots any longer. That's some True in some cases, surely. But don't you have concerns about the fact that corporate boardrooms now seem increasingly to be open to, if not actually represented on their membership by people of this radical left strain?
Well, that's a very good point, Frank, and you're absolutely right. And it's not just outside directors. I mean, you know, when they put Michelle Obama on their board or something like that, you know, you would expect that to be injected into corporate governance. But you have some big players like Larry Fink, who are apparently true believers in some of this leftist stuff, you know, in the mold of George Soros. And you kind of got to wonder where and when it started. You know, was Larry Fink a Marxist in college? And he's just now in a position where he can begin his piece of the revolution? Or, you know, is this something that he came to, you know, on the road to Damascus, or I guess on the road to Moscow, so to speak?
A very pregnant and important question. A quick further question. You are now a resident of Florida, George Raceley, and I wondered whether you think the Republican National Convention will take place as scheduled there in August in Jacksonville, despite what seem to be credible threats from Antifa and some of these other revolutionaries to disrupt the proceedings or at least try to cause violence to break out in that city in the midst of its meeting. And also, George, if I could ask you about this news report that the Chinese sent 10,800 conversion kits, or they were trying to send them to a residence in Melbourne, Florida, that would enable semi-automatic weapons to be converted into automatic weapons. What do you make of all of this and the prospects for the convention taking place there?
Well, I think that the convention is very likely to go forward. It's going to evolve. Having been in, you know, involved in a number of Republican national conventions, it would surprise me very much if it were canceled. As for the threats of violence, let's recall 4 years ago that the Democrats actually put $800,000 into a plan to disrupt the Republican convention in Cleveland. And they had the unions, the far left unions, and Antifa and BLM and all the usual suspects were there. The military and the law enforcement did a great job of keeping those disruptors at bay. There were a number of clashes, but they were not nearly as violent as anticipated in large measure because of the large security presence there. So it remains to be seen how things will go in Jacksonville. I think Governor DeSantis and the mayor of Jacksonville are very capable guys, and they get the potential for this. But it's certainly to be expected and to be a lot more intense, I think, than it was in Cleveland. With regard to the conversion kits going to Melbourne, that's not all that far away from where I am. I have some political consulting clients there in Brevard County. And, you know, the whole converting the AR-15 to be automatic or burst fire is a big issue for the Democrats and for the left. It's not really a difficult thing to do as a NRA firearms instructor and what have you. You know, the information is out there. What's truly astonishing is that these conversion kits would have been sent from China, and the ATF and the ATF and the FBI always want to make this out to be, you know, these backyard militia guys are the ones that are doing this. And that's simply not true. The left has a long history of firearms violations, and it does not surprise me at all that the Chinese are involved in this one.
And I'm afraid probably in a lot more that we haven't picked up on yet. George, we're over time. I wanted to talk to you about prospect of election fraud, but I hope you'll come back to us again very soon to discuss that. You have an excellent piece on the subject at Conservative HQ, and I strongly commend it to our listeners. Thank you for your time today, my friend. Come back to us again very soon. Next up, we'll speak with John Solomon, the author of an important new book on the Clintons and Biden dynasties, corruption, and more. Straight ahead.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back. I couldn't be more pleased to say we are joined by really a famous person at the moment. He has earned that reputation for investigative reporting that has put him in the pantheon of great journalists of our time. His name is John Solomon. These days he is the founder and leader of Just the News and a very storied history of reporting for a number of other organizations and editing positions, including where we work together most closely at the Washington Times, has given rise to a really highly astute understanding of the ways of Washington and an extraordinary ability to chronicle them and make them accessible to the rest of us. This is much in evidence in his brand new book, which I'm very pleased to have a chance to visit with him about today, Fallout: Nuclear Bribes, Russian Spies, and Washington Lies That Enriched the Clinton and Biden Dynasties. It's so good to have you with us, John. Thank you, and congratulations on this new, well, highly best-selling book. So the reporting that has gone into this book, John, is something that I think most of us have been watching and admiring for some time, notably your own writings, of course, in various outlets, but also your appearances on Sean Hannity's program and other Fox and other television shows. Talk to us a little bit about, perhaps first, this phenomenon of rampant corruption and the extent to which hostile powers have been behind it with respect to both the Bill and Hillary Clinton dynasty, if you will, and that of Joe Biden.
Yeah, absolutely. What I tried to do, because when the Russia story came out, we started in March of 17, and by January of 2020, we had done so many episodic things. We wanted to step back, kind of pull it all together, and then to answer the remaining questions. What questions do people still have? Can we get the data and the facts to back it up? And I think one of the biggest questions we set out to answer is, of all the things that Hillary Clinton could have done to pull a dirty trick, why did she choose Russia and Ukraine? What was the motive for using that as sort of the fake smokescreen to go after Donald Trump? And we dug in. We had about 100 interviews, about 10,000 pages of documents. And when we're done, what we learned is that Hillary Clinton, back in the summer of 2015, June of 2015, commissioned a private poll to determine which of her many liabilities would most stand in the way of her becoming president. And, you know, you've got Whitewater, Rose Offram billing records. You've got the Vince Foster scandal. You've got the Benghazi attacks. You've got the classified email investigation. But here's the amazing thing. All the ones we just rattled off, none of those were the largest impediment the poll showed. 53% of Americans that she polled said that the thing that most concerned them, that made them least likely to vote for Hillary Clinton, was her conduct in the Russia reboot, and the fact that she and her husband, the perception was cashing in on a foreign policy matter, with Bill Clinton getting $500,000 speech checks and the foundation collecting millions of dollars, her chief of staff getting a major Russian investment. All of those things sort of that concerned them more than anything else. And so the Clinton campaign set out to neutralize that issue. At the time they started the opposition research, they just didn't want any Republican. It didn't matter if it was Donald Trump or Marco Rubio, Ted Cruz, whoever was going to win. They didn't want this to be an issue in the fall, in the 2016 election because they knew it was a gigantic liability. So that gave rise to the opposition research project that ultimately led to Christopher Steele, and Christopher Steele leads to the bogus FBI investigation. So it was a desire by the Clintons and the Democrats to hide their biggest foreign policy failure, the Russia reboot, where they gave billions of dollars of nuclear fuel contracts, helped Moscow build a rival to our Silicon Valley called Skolkovo, and gave them the uranium under our ground and the Uranium One asset, and then had Vladimir Putin pull the rug out from under them and invade Ukraine. They wanted to hide that failure, maybe the greatest foreign policy failure in 50 years, and the fact that so many Democrats had cashed in on it while the bad policy was playing out.
This isn't just a case of political deflection, which, of course, the Democrats have proven to be extremely adept at. This was a vital effort to essentially transfer the Russia portfolio from a liability into a weapon that could be used against. And you're saying, John, that it wouldn't have mattered whether it was Donald Trump or any of these other Republican candidates, that they would have been similarly under assault in some form or fashion. This one with Donald Trump, of course, we've seen play out over the past couple of years. And you're reporting on it, by the way, and that of Sarah Carter, one of your colleagues, has been extraordinary in sort of illuminating all this. But are you saying that basically any Republican would have been subjected to a similar kind of assault?
Well, when it started, the Clinton campaign didn't think Donald Trump really even had a chance.
Neither did he, as it turns out.
Yeah, it turns out. That's right. Well, they wanted to neutralize it no matter who the nominee was. Now, as soon as Trump started taking steps and he started to emerge, you know, the focus switched from what are all the liabilities of the Republican Party to, oh, my gosh, he just hired Paul Manafort, dig into Paul Manafort. Oh, he just named Carter Page. But the goal was, no matter what Oppo research they did, it was all focused on finding some dirt, whether true or false, against the Republicans, contrived or factual, that would make the Republicans less likely to use this issue in the fall of 2016. It really shows the extraordinary impact of Peter Schweitzer's amazing book, Clinton Cash, because it did educate the public in such a way, and it stuck with the public, and it was a significant liability. And it turns out, the way they neutralized that liability was by creating false evidence, by submitting, you know, a false FISA and getting the FBI involved in one of the biggest dirty political tricks in American history.
Well, I'm not even sure there's anything close to it, really, as your research and documenting has pointed out. But John, let me just ask you to drill down on one of these topics in the litany that you've just described of scandalous, malfeasant, pay-to-play operations that Hillary Clinton ran when she was Secretary of State. Drill down on Skolkovo, if you will. What was going on there? And, you know, having their own Silicon Valley sounds like a sort of innocuous thing, but it was anything but, wasn't it?
Absolutely. One of the things that the Obama-Biden-Clinton team really underestimated is the cagey nature of Vladimir Putin. This is one of the themes in the book. They thought they could win him over with some love and some contracts and some nuclear business. And in fact, he had a chessboard full of ideas on how he was going to manipulate this process to restore Russia to its prior glory. He is a belief in the Russia. If you look at his career and his writings early on and his statements, his goal is to make Russia a great empire again. And the Democratic team just simply miscalculated. And so, when they set out to create Skolkovo, it's designed to give them a technology hub outside of Moscow. And Hillary Clinton brings over a whole bunch of Silicon Valley folks. There's a lot of technology transfers going on. And while we think we're just helping to prop up the Russian economy and make friends with Vladimir Putin, he's creating Skolkovo as an opportunity for intelligence and stealing business secrets and stealing technology and military secrets, particularly related to hypersonic missiles, which is one of the things that he has put a high priority on. And by the time the Clinton, Biden, Obama dynasty realized, oh my gosh, we've been taken to the cleaners, Skolkovo had become a significant area of corporate and military espionage. So we helped build an entity that would actually help undermine American technology, American security. It just shows how significant a failure the Russian reboot, which Joe Biden came up with, Hillary Clinton executed, and Barack Obama sanctioned, that how big a foreign policy failure it was. We played right into Putin's game. And I know that maybe one of the defenses of Democrats would say, well, nobody saw that coming. And the answer is, actually, your FBI did see it coming. The Robert Mueller FBI had an informant inside this entire enterprise warning time and time again what Vladimir Putin was up to. And nobody stopped him. No one stopped to listen.
You know, it wasn't just that informant, by the way. In the course of this, as I recall, John, both Army intelligence and Air Force intelligence warned that what this amounted to was an overt technology theft operation. And here's the thing. I mean, the subtitle of your book is important. You talk about the dynasties. The tragic fact of this is that this was a play that Bill Clinton exercised back in his presidency. He was giving technology, militarily relevant technology, including intercontinental ballistic missile technology, now employed on weapons pointed at us as the hypersonic missiles in Russia's arsenal are pointed at us, in a deal with the Chinese. Pay to play there, too. So, I mean, this isn't a case of any remote claim to innocence, is there, John? I mean, this is again, fool me once, shame on you. You know, fool me twice, shame on me. We have been duped by these people repeatedly, and they're not even being held accountable, are they?
No, not at all. Very little. The media doesn't even focus on these very critical issues. I think at the end of the day, when you pull up to 30,000 feet and you survey over what's going on, there have been two approaches to foreign policy in the last 30 years. One of them is the one made famous by President Reagan and is really at the core of President Trump's philosophy today, and that is peace through strength. We don't give our enemies aid and comfort. We remain strong, and we hope that our strength eventually brings it to the table for peace. The end of the Clinton administration, the second term of Bill Clinton's administration, all the way through the end of Barack Obama's administration, was a strategy of appeasement. We are going to give our enemies gifts, and we're going to ingratiate them. They're going to fall in love with us. And whether it was China or Russia, those were the primary things. And they underestimated two things: the determination of China and Russia to unseat America as a superpower, and the fact that appeasement only encourages spying and theft and all the things that we've now been victimized by.
Hey, John, we have to pause for just a second. I understand we'll have a second bite at this apple. We'll be right back with much more with John Solomon, the author most recently of Fallout, Nuclear Bribes, Russian Spies, and Washington Lies That Enriched the Clinton and Biden Dynasties. We're going to talk about the Biden part of this story next, right after this.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back. We are visiting with John Solomon, one of the country's great investigative reporters. You see him ubiquitously on your television screens, and I hope are following his work at justthenews.com, where he is the editor-in-chief, as well as the chief executive officer. He is the author of a brand new book, already a highly acclaimed bestseller, entitled Fallout: Nuclear Bribes, Russian Spies, and Washington Lies That Enriched the Clinton and Biden Dynasties. And I want to talk with you about the Biden piece of this, John. You mentioned that in before the break that Biden was kind of the architect of this reckless and, as I say, malfeasant effort to have rapprochement with Vladimir Putin. He was also, as I understand it, one of the people who was sort of a driver on the China portfolio for the Obama administration. You connected recently, John, a very important year in which two things happened, and I'd like to draw you out on it because it really was a prime example of this kind of play-to-play on the part of Joe Biden when he was the Vice President of the United States. Can you talk about those two things that happened in 2013?
Yeah, the transition period of late 2013 to early 2014 is the point where the Obama team, led by Biden, because remember, Obama didn't really like foreign policy. His idea was just don't do stupid stuff on foreign policy. He didn't have a foreign policy lens. And so Biden was brought to the ticket in 08 specifically because of the lack of foreign policy experience that Barack Obama had as a senator. So by 2013, it becomes readily apparent that the Russian reboot is a categorical failure. And it's at the same time that he's maneuvering. Now that Russia has, by February 2014, invaded Crimea and created a new international crisis, just like they had done in Georgia in 2008. You know, the history on this was very clear. Putin was an aggressor. And yet the Biden people thought that, well, we can win him over. Well, that's not going to ever be the case with Vladimir Putin. But this time frame is between December 2013 and the spring of 2014. They have to pivot. They've now made a big mistake. They've made Russia stronger economically, and now Russia's inside Crimea. They've thrown out the Russian president in Ukraine, and now Russia's got surrounded, a Russian-friendly president in Ukraine, and now Russia's got into Crimea. And so Biden has to pivot. And behind him is his son, Hunter Biden, who takes a trip with the vice president in, December 2013 to Beijing, where he sets up one investment opportunity, allegedly $1 billion or more, that was at least discussed at the time. He joins his father on that trip. And a new pattern is emerging. As Joe Biden is pivoting to solve the crisis that they have created with the Russian reboot, his son is sitting in the vapor trail, and he's trying to cash in on these extraordinary events. And so they go to China. There's Hunter Biden cashing in on it. By April, Biden shows up in Ukraine and he gives a speech and he says, you know how we're going to counter this Russian aggression? We are going to help Ukraine build a natural gas independence so they don't have to buy Russian gas, and that'll take some of the pressure off Ukraine. And by the way, he says in the speech, I've got some Americans with me who can probably help you guys get a jump start on this process. Now, we don't know who went on the plane and who he was referring it, because we haven't been able to get that manifest. But it is not 2 weeks later, just 2 weeks later, that Hunter Biden miraculously gets appointed to the largest Ukrainian natural gas company's board. And once again, you've got Hunter Biden flying in the vapor trail of his father trying to fix one of the major foreign policy blunders of the Obama administration. It wasn't just bad foreign policy. It was for profit. Exactly.
John, you identified two things that happened in 2013, but the one that I wanted you to go back to was one that preceded Hunter Biden's $1.5 billion deal with the Chinese, that you, I think, first connected the dots when you learned of this memorandum of understanding that he engineered, Joe Biden engineered with the Chinese to gain access to our capital markets on preferential terms. Can you just, again, put this into context, because it really puts into very sharp relief what Hunter was up to.
It's another example of the appeasement that the Obama-Biden Clinton team engaged in that put America in a lesser spot and our enemies in a stronger spot. So since the Sarbanes-Oxley rule, it's been a requirement that all companies that trade on U.S. markets, whether NASDAQ or Wall Street, they must abide by certain accounting principles. And that is something that the Chinese, though they wanted dearly to be in the capital markets, were not willing to do. They weren't willing to give the sort of transparency that protects investors by providing the level of accounting procedures and accountants and disclosures that are needed to make a fair and democratic market. And so, in a form of appeasement, the Obama-Biden team executes a memorandum of understanding that says, all right, China, listen, if you go a little way, you do a little bit of the accounting, we'll exempt you from all the other accounting procedures that went that go with Sarbanes-Oxley, and you can come into our market and get billions of dollars of fresh capital for Beijing to build your military companies, to build your Huawei's and all of your technology companies that now we know are being used to spy and do other horrific things, torture their Uyghurs and put them in concentration camps, all these horrible things. Again, what's amazing about it is even the few requirements that the Obama-Biden team threw in as sort of a bone, China thumbed their nose at. They have never complied with it. It's only taken to this year where President Trump has stepped up and now begun to attack that memorandum of understanding. They're in the process of withdrawing it, and it's going to change the relationship between China and the United States, But so much damage was done. 7 years of capital flowed to China unfairly and actually illegally under the forms of our government and under our laws.
Under our laws and regulations. Let me just challenge one proposition here, John, and it's just as much as anything to illuminate the point. You described this as appeasement. One of our mutual friends, John, talked about the $1.5 billion given to Hunter Biden in the aftermath of Joe Biden's engineering of a $3 trillion memorandum of understanding, not as a bribe, because that's a $20, maybe $50 million deal. $1.5 billion, he said, was a commission. Your thoughts?
Well, certainly, I've never been able to find any piece of evidence where there was an agreement implied or otherwise between the two events. But one of the things that the reason we have ethics laws, the reason we try to prevent American politicians from being able to engage in financial transactions with the people that they're supervising policy for, which, by the way, Barack Obama violated twice, China and Ukraine, is that it creates the appearance of a conflict of interest. Even if we never get the evidence, right, that proves that the two are a payoff, there's very little doubt that it creates distrust in our government by the bad decisions. When I went back through and you looked at all of the writings and rhetoric and speeches and policies and declassified documents, it is pretty clear to me that the Democrats had a delusional policy that perestroika, which did work to some degree in the fall of the Soviet Empire, was just going to be replicated. We could do it to China and they'll just fall in love with us. Give them a little Western culture and they'll just become Democrats. And that is a fundamental misunderstanding of the Chinese culture, philosophy, and the communist plan. Similarly, Vladimir Putin wasn't Boris Yeltsin. And once again, this idea that perestroika and friendship was the way to make things crumble, it failed. And I think that there was a philosophical thing that drove it. And then I think the greed comes in the vapor trail each time. You know, Hunter Biden knows that the Chinese feel good about his dad. Let me go cash in. He knows the Ukrainians feel good about his dad. Let me go cash in. I think we're going to find out there are other places in the world where the Biden family cashed in and have yet to be revealed. I also think there's another element to this because China and Russia like to have leverage on those that they're putting pressure on. I have a lot of reason to believe that China wanted to have the perception of corruption and leverage on Hunter Biden and would be willing to engage in this because it just gives you more power in the aftermath of it. That's why it's so dangerous to engage in these transactions.
John, we have to let you go. There's so much more to talk about. I hope you'll come back for a further conversation when you are less aggressively on the book-selling tour. Congratulations on this really important new book, and I wish you every success in bringing to the widest possible audience's attention your insights, because if the mantra of the Obama administration was don't do stupid things in foreign policy, you've documented that they did a lot. John, thank you again. Congratulations on Fallout: Nuclear Bribes, Russian Spies, The Washington Lies That Enriched the Clinton and Biden Dynasties. Keep it up, my friend. Come back to us again very soon. I hope the rest of you will join us again soon as well. Monday, same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.